Hey, Patrick. This is Elliot in New Orleans. I don't know why I'm calling exactly, except I just need to really kind of communicate what I'm feeling to someone. And if you feel like putting it on the podcast, you can, but you don't need to do that. Yeah, today is 7, I think, maybe after Hurricane Ida hit this area, New Orleans and southwest of here. And it's just been fucking crazy. It's been unbelievable. There's no power in about 75% of the city still a week later, and it's been extremely hot. A lot of people are getting bussed out, elderly folks, and it smells like garbage everywhere. And my wife and I are fortunate to have power as of about 2 days ago, so that's good. And I don't know, it's I would maybe describe the impact here in New Orleans as very, very disruptive, profoundly disruptive, but not quite catastrophic, at least for your average person. But my wife and I have been trying to stay very involved in relief and mutual aid stuff that's happening both locally and regionally. And today we took our first trip into some of the areas that were worst affected by this storm, like Galliano and Golden Meadow, sort of southwest of New Orleans, these bayou towns. And I don't know, it's just something that I've never seen in my life. And it's kind of indescribable. I mean, just trees everywhere, every roof cleaved off, buildings just blown down by 150, 160 mile an hour winds. The level of destruction is kind of unfathomable. And the thing that maybe shook me the most, you know, there are all these cypress bayous, these swamps here, down there. And the further south you get, the barer and barer the trees get. I mean, they got their leaves shaken all the way off them to where by the time you're down there near Grand Isle, it looks like winter in the middle of the summer. And that's going to be seared in my brain forever. And I don't even have...
As you can hear there, that message with Elliot cut off. He was about to say something else. And unfortunately, the limit for the voicemail that I set up for the Drop Me a Line feature of this podcast is 3 minutes. But I did get a hold of Elliot, and he's doing good. And I thought it was appropriate to feature this call here with this interview with Sophie Strand, because at the beginning of the interview with Sophie, we talk about Hurricane Ida and the impact that it had on the northeast of the United States. This is the reality of the time we're living in, where we have extremely disruptive climate change-related weather events. This is the reality that we have stepped into. And I also want to state that Elliot's called once before and left a message, and actually set up a call with him, Tal Ryan, and Dr. Khalil Avi. I featured Avi on an episode of the podcast as well, in which we talked about invasive species and ecology. And it was a really great discussion. I was really happy that I could connect a listener of the podcast with two individuals that know a hell of a lot more about so-called invasive species and ecology than I do. So that was a really great discussion between all of us. Anyway, Elliot, thank you very much for the call. I really hope you're doing well, all things considered. And like I said, this is the reality that we're living in currently. And this is what this podcast is about, ultimately. If you would like to leave a call like Elliot did, you can call the phone number 208-918-2837. You can leave a message up to 3 minutes in length. Or if you follow the link in the description or you go to my website, you'll find a link there as well. You can drop an audio file directly, which you can upload, and I can feature it on the podcast if you wish. Or you can just send me a message to let me know what you're thinking or feeling. Just let me know what the intention is in the call. All right, everybody, thank you so much. On with the episode.
storytelling is an emergency. It's not like a cute thing. It's not like you want to write a story that's going to make you famous. You want to tell the story that's going to keep you alive. Like Scheherazade, her stories are these adrenaline-fueled attempts to actually save her life. And so as we tell stories, we should ask ourselves, what are the stories that will keep me alive? Because if they keep me alive, they may keep other people alive. But then I was thinking about storytelling, as I often do, as being a non-human event, as being something that we belong to, but we didn't invent. And I was thinking about the Earth itself, you know, Gaia, the Great Mother, whatever you, with the biosphere, you know, as being a kind of Scheherazadean character that is telling these stories with hurricanes, with heat waves, with forest fires to try and get our attention, to stay alive. Say, come on, pay attention. We are so culturally shut down to our sensory experience that I feel like we've been sensorially receiving climate information for a long time. Like you mentioned smell, and I was thinking, like, I think that things have probably smelled wrong for a long time, but it's things are just loud enough now that in our very shuttered, very simplistic existence, we're finally paying attention.
In this episode, I speak with Sophie Strand. Sophie is a writer based in the Hudson Valley who focuses on the intersection of spirituality, storytelling, and ecology, but it would probably be more authentic to call her a neo-troubadour animist with a propensity to spin yarns that inevitably turn into love stories. Give her a salamander and a stone and she'll write you a love story. Sophie was raised by house cats, puffballs, possums, raccoons, and an opinionated, crippled goose. In every neighborhood she's ever lived in, she has been known as the walker. She believes strongly that all thinking happens interstitially between beings, ideas, differences, and mythic radiance. Sophie and I entered this conversation a bit fuzzy, a little stunned. We do often nowadays. We wake up, we look at our phones, we check the news. We acknowledge that we had done that morning, and we were still processing some devastating news that Ida, of course, that's what Elliot described there in that call, Hurricane Ida had crashed and dragged itself from south to north across the East Coast, overwhelming the infrastructure, shutting down the grid, and flooding cities. And so at the beginning of this discussion, we talk about how climatologically and ecologically we are feeling how things have shifted tremendously. Whether that be in the Northwest, where I live, at the time I was recording the interview, I was still in Southern Idaho, and in the Hudson Valley, where Sophie lives. So personally, I tend to explore these broad subjects on the podcast, of course, but Sophie writes about it. In her essay, Storytelling is an Emergency, an Ecological Reading of Scheherazade, she writes, "We are entering into an ecological 1001 nights of climate change. We are entering into a series of stories that are desperately trying to save their teller, the Earth, Gaia, the biosphere, whatever word for you encompasses the sum total of spherical, gravity-bound life. Will we, like King Shahryar, halt our violence and begin to listen to a new, non-human kind of story? Will we let these stories change us and reform us? Ultimately, it matters not whether we do or do not. This series of stories will not depend on a human scribe. It will be written into the stone mantle of the earth itself." That was actually one of the essays that Sophie had published that compelled me to contact her. She was responding to the IPCC report that just came out sometime before that essay was written. I've been following Sophie for some time. I find her writing to be touching on sensations, feelings, themes, subjects that are not only intoxicating, but just really compelling. I felt really compelled to talk with Sophie, to get to know her work a bit more, to get to know her a bit more, just to see where the conversation would go. We then move into discussing two of her upcoming book projects, in particular one that's coming out called The Madonna Secret, which is a ecofeminist historical fiction reimagining of the Gospels. That's going to be published sometime next year. We We also discuss the Flowering Wand, Lunar Kings, Lycanized Lovers, Transspecies Magicians, and Rhizomatic Harpists Heal the Masculine, another book that she is going to be publishing as well. And so I think, Sophie, I really think her work is really incredible. I would really ask that you follow her work. She posts on Instagram and on Facebook a lot. That's where most of her essays are published. And she's had some other published work in other places as well. And of course, her upcoming books. She also has several books of poetry released, including Love Song to a Blue God and Those Other Flowers to Come and The Approach. So please go check out her work. She just got a website put up, which you can find at sophiestrand.com. I'll be putting a link to that website. It's a good base to find all of her work and to find all the other podcasts and other talks that she's given as well. If you would like to learn more about my work specifically, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you'd like to support my work on a monthly or yearly basis and really keep this work going, you can do that through Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. If you contribute there, you'll gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly. If you'd like to send a one-time donation, you can do that through PayPal or Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast or find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. All right, everybody, thank you so much for your attention. Here's my interview with Sophie Strand. Well, Sophie, we're both a mess, mm-hmm. but, you know, I just started recording because we already started talking about stuff, and I'm just like, might as well start recording and just, you know, see what sticks here at the beginning, at least, and I want to thank you for coming on the podcast.
Well, thank you really for appreciate having it. Me. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really happy to have you on. Yeah, we were just discussing kind of where we're located geographically within what we call the United States and on this continent. And you were just describing you being up in the Hudson Valley. Is that right?
Hudson Valley, yeah. Right at the confluence of the Rondout Creek and the Hudson River. Yeah.
Okay. Right. So just, I was just mentioning, we were both talking about our morning.
Yeah.
Kind of where we're at right now. I just was reading, I have a bad habit of reading the news too early in the morning, and
me too. Yeah.
It's a bad habit because it puts you in a funk, right? I mean, yeah. It can at least. And the news is on one level meant to, there is this sort of like enforced or this sort of, what is the word I'm trying to think of? It does hyper-focus on certain issues to the point where it just puts everybody in a collective state of anxiety and that's a part of it, but you know, on a real level, I mean, a lot of stuff is really happening simultaneously right now that is very disturbing, and you know, situated within the climate crisis, and also just politically in the U.S., things are going further and further to the right, more restrictive towards. Like, I was just thinking about the abortion ban in Texas that was upheld by the Supreme Court, basically. So all of these things just put me in a mood. And you were talking also about your, would I call it a disease or a certain condition that you have that put you in a certain
genetic condition that has predisposed me to a bunch of other conditions. So it's kind of like a constellation of conditions that are all spring from this one genetic glitch.
Right.
Yeah.
Glitch. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess we're both in this, but I think this is actually an interesting place to be in to do.
Yeah, certainly.
An interview.
This is a time, you know, I always think of Garcia Lorca's essay about the Duende, like we're dancing in the wound. This is the raw moment, you know. Real art, real interesting things can come out of it, but whoa.
I know. I was having a conversation with my partner and we're actually going to be moving in together here pretty soon. That's partly, I mentioned I was going to be moving up to Washington. So that's a part of it. But, you know, when you make big life decisions and you're, you know, doing things, there's just this space that you're in of transition. And it's easy for me to, I don't know, I'm trying to be like consoling or affirming in the relationship and being, you know, we're going through this thing together. We're making these big changes in our life. And there's a lot of things that are just uncertain. There's this like middle space that you're in between things, and it can produce anxiety, of course. And that space, though, is, I think I kind of framed it like it's a special place because there's a lot of things that come into your life and lots of fluidity and change. And it's easy for me to say that, you know, it's easy to like frame it that way and be, you know, I don't know if consoling is the right word, but affirming and supportive. But when you're in it, it's really hard to see it as that, yeah. You know?
And well, that's and something I always think about, you know, yeah. When you have trauma happen, when you have illness, people are always like, it's an initiation. It's a rite of passage. And I'm like, well, if it's really like that, you don't know it inside of it. It's only an initiation if you survive. And you don't know if you're going to survive when you're really in it. So I think yeah. Those liminal realms, those moments of you know, they're the kind of the Keatsian idea of negative capability. Can you live with the question, with the uncertainty? Can you really yeah. not know if you're going to survive?
Right. Yeah, and I've... Yeah, it's like that thing where it's like I acknowledge the nature of it being an initiation, but sometimes initiatory processes kill people.
Well, that's what I was thinking, and especially like yeah. something, you know, I've been thinking about, and some other people have been parsing this out as well. So I'm definitely like, you know, a compost heap of other thinkers. You know, Tom Hirons, the poet, was talking about this in an interview I listened to with him, is, you know, initiations within, you know, communities that are rooted and have actually historical land-based practices they have rules, and that you have elders who've been through them, and you have a history of people having survived these experiences to guide you through them. You know, we don't have anyone on the other side. We don't have a midwife for this experience. There's no extinction climate apocalypse doula. I mean, there yeah. is. It's the earth, and it's the understanding that being a human isn't the most important thing, but that's not like another human being pulling you through the call, like, you know,
right,
delivering you.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's this, it's a, I don't know what the feeling is, or how I would describe that feeling. It's a lot. It's really a lot. Yeah. I don't know how else to say it.
No, I mean, I think, you know, I think a lot about somatics, and mm-hmm. I think modern somatics is really problematic and complicated. And you know, mm-hmm. There's some good stuff, there's some bad stuff, but I do think the window of tolerance is interesting in how you oscillate. And, you know, when your nervous system is dysregulated, you're always going in and out of being way too activated. And becoming reactionary or becoming totally paralyzed. And I was thinking that culturally we're in this like wild oscillation. We're never within a window of tolerance right now. There's never any moment to bring the cultural, social nervous system into alignment.
You know, it's like, I had an experience, right before the pandemic, really. Not even before it began, but before we started reacting to the pandemic.
Yeah.
I had a personal experience where I was in that state of just like oscillating and going from just above and then below. And it was just, it was really informative for me to learn like why that was happening eventually. But now I'm feeling like it's happening on a collective level.
Yeah.
And that's a different thing. Thing.
No, it's like you're riding the wave, and the waves are unpredictable. There are lots of different metaphors, you know, as a poet, as a writer, I'm always thinking about what metaphor fits, and every day it's a different one.
Right.
Chaotic.
Chaotic, yeah. Yeah, well, I guess I was maybe on a practical level asking, because Hurricane Ida
yeah.
hit the East Coast, and like New York State, or at least the city of New York and other parts of like, I think New Jersey as well, and other parts of the East Coast are flooded, and, you know, people are like, okay, here we are. You know, here's this thing. This is new, or not new, but relatively new. How is it where you're at?
I would say the past 4 years in the Hudson Valley have been, Well, here's the interesting thing. You can read the news, but when you get distracted by the macrocosm, global news, you stop listening to the quote-unquote news outside your house. Weather, the animals, the slight variations in vegetation, when things grow. I mean, I'm a person who spends a lot of time outside, and so I feel like I noticed about 3 years ago that things were changing climactically really, really fast. So for me, it was like 3 years ago, I was like, this is a different ecosystem. There are trees that are dying. The invasive species are bringing them down. There are like different waves of flowers that are happening at different times. I could really feel it about 3 years ago. And I feel like people now, like local ecologists and people are like, oh, look at this. And I'm like, yeah, were you paying attention? And now it's really loud in New York State, but it's been, you know, the music has been rising for about 3 years, as far as I can tell, with extreme heat and extreme humidity. Like the Hudson Valley is pretty much a tropical zone at this point. Like houses are rotting and falling apart. People don't have the infrastructure, the central air or heating to keep their houses from falling apart. So, I mean, on a very like dramatic level, we have flooding. You know, New York City is shut down today. People can't get around. People can't get to doctor's appointments. They can't get to the hospital. They can't see relatives that are dying. You know, so that's happening. But, you know, it's also slower and more gradual. You know, houses are falling apart. Rivers are drying up, and then other rivers are overflowing and totally changing and melding into other rivers. It's an interesting moment.
Yeah.
How are you seeing it where you are? What does it feel like ecologically?
I live in a very agricultural region.
Yeah.
So it's actually interesting because I, you know, preparing for this interview, I had listened to some other interviews that you had done. One with Dare Sohei. There was another one. I can't remember their name, but you talk a lot about your connection to the land or the ecology that you are embedded within. And that's actually part of something I've struggled with personally, is not having that level of connection to where I live. And I wonder why a lot. And I've wondered that out through the podcast a bit, why I don't feel very connected to where I'm from. And so I've explored it through all these different lenses and different perspectives and stuff. But I don't know. I think part of it, honestly, is I just think here it's very agricultural. It's been colonized to such a great degree that I don't know. I don't really feel like I live in that much connection to the place I'm at. And I wonder why that is. I'm still trying to figure that out a little bit, the nuances of that. But I'll just say on a basic level, heat waves, you know, we had a lot of heat waves this summer. I know that like farmers are struggling with water, the droughts, mega drought, I guess they call it now. I think there's a general anxiety about how the economy is going to function anymore with these sort of limited resources, if you want to call them resources, but water and things like that. So that's, you know, and actually I went up to go up to Washington when the first heat wave hit there. And it was really surreal because I arrived right when it was beginning. And as I was driving on the freeway, there was traffic had been slowed down and stopped for a period of time because there were firefighters that had stopped on the side of the road to stop a fire from breaking out because it was just so dry. And then as I arrived, like, I mean, I was in Olympia and a few other areas, and it was like peaking around 100 or plus 100 degrees. It was just so surreal. It did not feel right. It was just so out of almost character, if I could say that, about what it's like to be in that region. It felt very strange. It was almost a fever dream. That's what it felt like to me. So anyway, this whole region just sort of feels that way. It just, everything just feels out of sync, out of alignment. That's my general sense of things right now, where I'm at.
Yeah, Fever Dream feels like a good articulation. There's a kind of uncanniness to it, like a spookiness to what's happening. It's like when someone you think you know really well starts to act in a really unpredictable way. I mean, I feel, so I grew up in the Hudson Valley, actually. So for me, it feels, definitely feels like, wow, you were doing things I never thought you were going to do. This is not the place I remember. And I don't really want to put my anthropocentric moral interpretation onto that. I don't think it's bad or good. I just think it is happening and it is weird.
I actually wrote about this a little bit. I had an experience where I went up to Port Townsend, which is right on the, I guess the peninsula, I guess in Washington, on the very northern part there. And I had dinner with some good friends, and then we went on a little walk through the woods. And the woods were shaded enough; it was actually cooling down in the evening. It was like right as the sun was about to set. And we walked up to the coastline, and actually, as we left the trees and got to the coastline, it was so hot. It actually got hotter the closer we got to the ocean, and it was so weird. There was this like smell in the air, like I don't know how to explain the smell. It was like salty, but like a sauna or I don't know. I can't quite explain the scent, but there was just something so distinctive, and it was just so hot, and it was really bleak. Like you just looked out over the coastline, and it just felt very bleak and wrong. Like something was wrong about that feeling, and it felt really surreal and dreamlike. And that really stuck with me. That really, really stuck with me. And I guess I would like to, you know, point to, I guess, a relatively short essay of yours, but you were, you had written a little piece about, I mean, you kind of started talking about the IPCC report, because we are talking about climate. I feel like it's appropriate to bring this up. Could you talk a bit about that essay?
Which one is this?
This is the one, I know, you've written some. No, this one, you had written about, it was a...
Oh, the Scheherazade, right? And the 1001 stories and the stories of an emergency?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that was it.
Well, that essay kind of uses Scheherazade and the story of the woman who, the king... who kills a woman every night. He weds a woman and kills her every night. And then his vizier's daughter is chosen to be his newest bride. And she knows that to survive, she has to keep him from killing her. So every night she tells him a story that's so good that he wants to keep her alive for another night to tell a story. And for a long time, you know, I've taught young women writing. I've taught, you know, creative writing workshops for young women. And the story had always been a way of me kind of entering into a more dynamic way of getting them to tell the stories that they actually care about. Saying storytelling is an emergency. It's not like a cute thing. It's not like you want to write a story that's going to make you famous. You want to tell the story that's going to keep you alive. Like Scheherazade, her stories are these adrenaline-fueled attempts to actually save her life. And so as we tell stories, we should ask ourselves, what are the stories that will keep me alive? Because if they keep me alive, they may keep other people alive. But then I was thinking about storytelling, as I often do, as being a non-human event, as being something that we belong to, but we didn't invent. And I was thinking about the earth itself, you know, Gaia, the Great Mother, whatever you, the biosphere, you know, as being a kind of Scheherazadean character that is telling these stories with hurricanes, with heat waves, with forest fires to try and get our attention, to stay alive, to say, come on, pay attention. And I think that's the interesting thing is we are so culturally shut down to our sensory experience that I feel like we've been sensorially receiving climate information for a long time. Like you mentioned smell, and I was thinking like, I think that things have probably smelled wrong for a long time, but it's things are just loud enough now that in our very shuttered, very simplistic existence, we're finally paying attention. But the stories have to get loud.
Yeah, that seems to be the... This was something that was touched on with Dare in that conversation you had with them.
Yeah.
That our culture, if you want to call it that, or civilization or whatever it is, really shutters off our senses and our ability to sense things. I mean, with all the senses we have.
Yeah, so, I think people are so attracted to these big heroic psychedelic experiences. They just want to turn on their senses. Okay, a psychedelic experience will wake up those senses, but you also have that available to you every single day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've talked about psychedelics. I've kind of backed off a bit just because I haven't had many lately in my life. But I think it was one of those things where when I had that first mushroom experiences mostly, the senses that my sense of smell, taste, and not just them as distinct separate categories of senses, but they were blending together in such a particular way. And it was overwhelming because I was realizing in that experience, like I had access, I felt like on some level I had access to this the entire time, but I, whether consciously or not, didn't want to have that intensity of felt experience because it was too much to like live in this place and in this time and with my body in this, like it was too much to take in all the time because it was hard. It was hard.
And I also think that sensory gating is a survival technique. Like you want to be able to hear your name called in a room of people talking. So you have to be able to gate out all the other noise to distinguish your name. You know, you want to be able to see an animal coming at you through the woods. So you have to be able to block out all the other visual stimuli. So you see that perturbation, that movement. So I think that gating is actually something that is helpful. The problem is that I think the way we used to homogenize our the kind of sensory stimuli we register had a lot more to do with an understanding of how land worked and how weather worked. But now it has to do with abstractions and with structures that are totally man-made and have nothing to do with our actual somatic survival. So I think that's the really hard thing is we do need to gate out, you know, to let in all the stimulus is to be totally overwhelmed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But how do we begin to play with that doorway, opening it a little bit, letting in a little bit more, closing it?
Yeah, you know, in your writing, you talk a great deal about mycelium.
Yeah.
You talk about, and you use that as not only, it's more than just a metaphor for you. I think that it actually is, there's a sensory or.
It's a lyrical ideogram. It's the thing that arrived to me that helped my brain work. I don't even mean that it's like a substance I took. I mean, like it was a way of thinking. And I think we all have our cognitive companions that come and help us think. Yeah.
How did that come to you?
I think I loved mushrooms when I was little. I mean, I grew up in the Hudson Valley and I was always like down on the ground and like looking at things and like pulling up like roots and looking at little dangly mycelium. Not that I knew that what that was at that point. But for me, it was really this aha moment of realizing I was in college where I was fascinated with mycorrhizal networks and there wasn't that much information about them yet. And I had read Deleuze and Guattari and found it to be like really, really interesting and dry and like not rooted in ecology. And I was trying to find some way to think about rhizomes in a much more ecologically, scientifically interesting way and doing this research. And as that was happening, as my love of mycology and fungi was deepening into this mycorrhizal area of study, I got diagnosed finally. I'd been mysteriously ill for a really long time with a connective tissue disease. And so it was this very kind of vertiginous, weird moment where I was like fascinated with the connective tissue of the soil and realizing that all of my health issues were connective tissue issues. So it was like a moment where I realized that this was like had been planted in my body genetically, like since birth. So yeah, I mean, and that's my interpretation, but it definitely felt like I had grown into my purpose. I had found the being that I was wedded to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I feel like I'm trying to figure out how to ask this question or say this, but my experience with mushrooms, we were just touching on psychedelics, but the experiences that I've had with them has always felt like it was an actual intelligent being, or not even a being. It felt like a collection of beings.
Yeah.
And it was showing me things, and it was actually speaking to me almost in this hive mind thing. It was very, and it was mischievous, but also it contained multitudes, I guess.
Yeah. It feels like it feels chattering. It feels like it has a lot to say. And it's bumptious and kind of unruly, puckish. You know, I always think of the fermented gods, like very Dionysian. I've had that experience too, and I've done mushrooms. For me, the big experience, the big paradigm shift was about time. When I had psilocybin experience, I experienced time as flowing backwards. And as feeling my future flowing back into me and feeling moments begin to recursively spiral. It was a real, it troubled my idea of the arrow of time.
Yeah. Yeah. Seems like mushrooms, when they do that, it seems like it does disrupt not only your perception of time, but the way it flows.
Yeah.
And that seems like a common thing. And I think there's a lesson in that, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, quantum physics and, you know, Libet's delay, there's a lot of pretty mainstream science out there that says we don't really understand how time works. Is it this kind of a Minkowski like cube? Like, are we just like a snake that exists along our whole timeline and we're experiencing this one moment, but we really exist along our whole life? I mean, there are lots of interesting questions about that, especially about readiness potential. Do you know about this?
Mm-mm.
You know, they've done these studies. Lipid studies are the most famous ones. I think those were in the 80s. Where they would show that people would make decisions, but their bodies were registering them and preparing them before they cognitively made the decision. And also that you can shock someone and they'll be preparing for it in their body before they receive the shock without knowing that they're going to receive it. So all these strange temporal kind of glitches in scientific studies that trouble our ideas of free will, of causality.
Do you think that when we're talking about I think you said sense gating?
Yeah, sensory gating, yeah.
Sensory gating, yeah. That part of our sensory apparatus or our ability to anticipate things on that sort of that way you've described time itself, that like taking a psychedelic experience, which just feels like a door gets flung open, right? Yeah. That are kind of feeling this out right now.
Yeah, go for it.
That by doing that, by having that experience you described with time, that is a part of our, I'm going to use the say sensory apparatus, but our ability to anticipate something that's like pulling us towards it. We may not know what that thing is, but we know that we are about to do it, or it is about to be done to us.
Yeah, I mean, have you read anything by Eric Worgo?
I haven't.
Okay, really, really fun. Or listen to his interview with Michael Garfield on Future Fossils, like whatever. He's an amazing he's an amazing like amateur. He's a hobbyist. He loves science. He loves quantum physics. He acknowledges that this is like not his area of expertise, and yet he still writes about it in a very interesting, compelling way. And he's interested in the fact that pretty much all cultures up until very recently believed in some form of precognition and precognitive dreams and prophecy. And that if we actually look at how dreams work, I mean, Freud, this is fascinating. Freud had to work really hard to disprove how many prophetic dreams he was having and his patients were having. And if you actually look at them on paper all together, you're like, whoa, that's a lot. Like, you have to really work hard at a certain point to say, what's going on here? And I think in our own lives, we can look back at our biographies and see that we've been kind of primed and made ready for certain events in ways that we couldn't know about as they were happening. But if we look backwards, we see that we were kind of the guardian angel of our own self. We were like positioning ourselves perfectly.
Yeah, I think a lot of us have had similar experiences that are like that. I wonder what that means on a collective level. You know, we're discussing climate and, you know, that it's like really loud now. It's just like everything's happening. And I feel like everything that's been happening for the past few years, at least, because I think we've been, you know, in our bones, we've known that this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And in a way, like my friend, we were talking about this. He describes like the sort of mass psychosis that we're experiencing seemingly. Is because of this deep denial of something that we've already been sensing, that the earth is changing, and it's we know the reasons.
Yeah.
And and it's affecting us on a behavioral level. And we're seeing the results of that now, you know.
Well, and I think that the culture has been gaslighting the people who felt this on a very bodily, very real level, you know. One of my close family friends is a climate journalist, and for about 15 years, he's been talking about this. And he said to me, I remember like 5 years ago, he was like, the apocalypse is happening already. It just hasn't drifted upwards. It's affecting all of the South. It's affecting the minorities. It's affecting the poorest populations, the third world countries. It just hasn't quite reached us yet. But it's not like going to happen. It has happened.
Right.
And I think this past year has really been that, you know, the wave has finally reached us. It's here. It was already happening, but now we're feeling the effects.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like all this, I think that's the thing. I don't know if it's not justice or retribution. I don't know what it is. It's none of those words, but it's that thing of, you know, there's no place to go in this. There's no way to escape it. There's always been, I think, within the way things have played out over hundreds of years through colonization and global capitalism and the hierarchies that are imposed because of that, and you could go through all of that, that to a certain degree, those of us in the global north, and particularly those that have benefited under sort of a patriarchal form, have been able to buffer themselves on some level from the impacts of that that hierarchy, you know, on people that have been kind of exploited under that, right? We can buffer ourselves from the effects of that, but this is one of those things where I don't see how, you know, it really is bubbling up to the top.
Yeah.
And affecting those that have.
Something that's been talked about for a couple of years in chronic and terminal illness groups that I've participated in has been that, you know, more and more young people are very seriously ill. And I think that there has been an experience that, like, people who have disability and chronic illness have felt this beforehand. They've felt that precognitive pulse in their own bodies. And I do think that there are people who are kind of the canaries in the coal mine who feel these things beforehand. And I have noticed that there have been, I felt more seen ecologically and more believed about climate change when I was in groups of people who were the survivors of abuse and trauma and seriously ill. It was an interesting thing, phenomenon, that those were the people, they felt it in their bodies before other people did.
Yeah, I mean, has your, the condition that you have, has that allowed you to, do you feel like you yourself feel like a canary in the coal mine on a certain level? Like, that you're able to perceive and feel things or experience things in a way that others maybe can conveniently ignore? Do you feel that way about yourself, at least? And
I think whenever you have a non-normative physical experience, you can either frame it as being a symptom or as a superpower. And it really depends on how you want to narrativize it. I think that my body is extraordinarily sensitive to chemicals and to toxins and to foods and to stimuli in a way that is often like very, very dramatic. So that can be scary and intense and could limit my life if I wanted it to, but it's also a way of thinking about my body as being kind of like an alarm signal. Like, like I'm like the fire alarm in the house where there's a gas leak and no one else has noticed it yet, but I'm going off. Which is, you know, it's interesting. And the joke has always been, I sensed a gas leak in my house before we actually got it noticed and no one else sensed it. So I'm always sensitive to these small changes in chemicals and, pesticides and toxins.
Well, I think that makes sense when I talking about this, because like reading your essays, there's a very, I mean, it's like a palpable sensual thing that I feel when I read that. And you write that into whatever it is, and it's just, it's felt. And I think that's part of why I mean, that's how I became aware of you, is because of how I think you're becoming incredibly popular as far as people that really appreciate your writings are sharing them, which is well deserved. It's like you've taken this thing, and I'm not here to do this thing where it's like you have a disability or this issue and you've like, you know, pulled yourself up by your bootstraps and made yourself this, you know, I'm not doing that. But I do think that through that way that you're living in your body, you've become attuned to something that most people are kind of numb to.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that I've been thinking about is if you're so in your body, like, you know, extreme pain events, extreme, like I've had NDEs, like where I thought I was going to die and everyone else thought I was going to die. They bring you back into your body, actually, in such an exquisite, intense way. And you can think about that as being agonizing, but it also makes you available to extreme pleasure. And so what I want to make available to people is, to embody, to drop back into ourselves right now is to feel the pain. But it is also to feel the pleasure that we have been denying ourselves for so long. They both exist simultaneously. We have to be able to hold them both.
Yeah, I think with the general feeling of the time we're in, there is just an intensity of experience, because, you know, with some close friends that I talk about the climate crisis with and all of this stuff with, they're like, this is a hell of a time to be in love, you know, or this is a hell of a time to be any, like, in an impassioned relationship or experience with anything. It's not just like another person or other people. It's like with your work.
Even interesting times, right? The worst curse you can give to someone. I think, you know, it's funny. My primary passion is as a storyteller, as a fiction writer. That's like what I wanted to do with my life and what I would like to do. Like all of this nonfiction has come about through basically through the pandemic and me just being like feeling like I've been shoved in a corner. And like just given this one way of communicating, and I was like, okay, I'll take it, I'll do it. But the thing I'm most interested in is long format storytelling and love stories, tragic love stories. And it's so funny that this is what I've always wanted to write, and now I'm like, oh, but now I'm in this extraordinarily tragic time. What does ecological storytelling look like when it comes off the page and slips into your own life?
Right. Yeah, you know, when I was preparing for the interview and I had this thought of like how the interview begins for anybody, whoever I'm interviewing or speaking with, like that sets the flow or the direction of the conversation. And it ended up being something that was kind of beyond my control on a certain level. Like we're both in this place and the news and everything that's going on. So, but one of those subjects was around the climate, and we've touched a lot on that. Now you're touching on fiction that you write. I mean, so you have like two book projects. I wanted to get to this because you have a lot of two that I know of at least.
Two that are sold and will be out in the next year. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So the one like this one was really something I wanted to ask because it's like the other two subjects I wanted to talk about was relating to Christianity, and then the other was masculinity, and those are bound up together.
Yeah.
Right. For sure. So. You had made an announcement on social media about the Madonna Secret.
Yeah, finally.
And if you could describe the premise of that a little bit, and then we can maybe like talk a little bit about that. Yeah.
I've always been fascinated by this. You know, I'm a lover of stories and was raised by spiritual scholars who both had like an extraordinary respect for the sacredness of life and also a very, very critical view of religion. So I've always been interested about why people thought the story of Jesus was a happy story. It's always read as a Shakespearean tragedy to me. And, and I've also been interested about how does this Galilean rabbi get perverted into this figure that inspires thousands of years of genocide and ecocide? What goes wrong? I mean, I've always thought, I pretty much wrote this book because no one else was writing it. And I reached a bottleneck moment in my life where I was like, well, it looks like I have a year to live. Really, this is like most of my writing projects usually happen at critical moments. And I was like, I've been putting off this project, but I should probably just write it now. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write an ecological feminist reimagining of the Gospels from the perspective of Miriam of Bethany, also known as Mary Magdalene. Where I wanted to really bring back to life in a super sensual, historically textured way, the people of Galilee and Judea and the tricky Galilean storytelling rabbi that might have been Yeshua. And I wanted to reframe the Gospels as a Shakespearean tragedy, where when you finally reach the crucifixion, it's a trap. You don't want this person to die. this is not how things were supposed to happen. It was an incredibly intense project. The minute I took it on, it was like a possession experience. It was just, it took over my whole life. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The thing about Christianity is like, I grew up in I've talked about it before. I actually grew up in the Mormon church. So it's kind of a weird version of Christianity.
I've had some friends who've been Mormon and ex-Mormon.
Right. Yeah.
How do you feel?
So I've had.
What is your feeling about that now?
Well, I left the church when I was. I mean, I stopped going and became, you know, left the church when I was probably in my late teenage years and then my early 20s. I like officially like I'm like I don't want any association with the church. It wasn't this like deeply I didn't have this like animosity or this anger at first, at least. And then eventually it did turn into not anger, but more of just like what did this do to me as far as my development and how it affected people around me? But then it turned into almost an anthropological, if that's the right way to say that, kind of a fascinating view of like how it affected. I've looked at it through the lens of like settler colonialism. I've looked at it through the lens of like American exceptionalism. I've looked at it through the lens of, kind of patriarchy. I've looked at it through all these different lenses and it allowed me to kind of unpack it a little bit. And then I've come to this other place where it is one branch on a larger branch of what Christianity has become over the centuries, yeah. really. And then I've had these experiences where the archetype of Christ himself seems to have a resonance with me, and I don't know why, and I haven't quite figured that or sussed that out yet. So, like, reading about what your book project is about made me think, like, well, there's so many different ways that you can imagine this story of Christ, or, you know, this this rabbi, as you've described him. And I just found, like, the way you're approaching the subject is really it's fascinating, and I think it could actually be really liberating on a certain level, because I've come to understand, like, we can kind of make what we want of these things. It doesn't have to be what we maybe grew up believing it was. I don't know how else to say that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's pretty much my whole ethos. Mm-hmm. My whole drive is in taking these stories, you know, scripture and storytelling used to be a constantly adapting organism. It didn't use, you know, it's only in the movement to phonetic alphabets and to text and to written text mm-hmm. that stories break down and ossify. They stop adapting to changing climatological, social, cultural conditions. Used to be that myths and stories and scripture were told and changed and reinterpreted. So I think that it's our responsibility sometimes to not throw away these stories that have been so problematic, but to the thing that I always try and do is trying to plant them back in their original ecological context. So really look at them critically. Say, okay, so what was really going on here? Who wrote the story? What was their agenda? What got lost? What's really there? Are there other primary documents that I can kind of refract around? So to try and resuscitate a lived sensual ecological experience, plant the story. I mean, stories get abstracted when we write them down on the page, and then try mm-hmm. and disseminate them to other cultures and other ecosystems and pretend like they'll still work. So I try and replant myths and stories in their original context, but then it's also about composting them and changing them, adapting them, saying, what can this tell me about my current situation? How can I change mm-hmm. the story so that it's nourishing to me right now in the Hudson Valley, in the United States, in late stage apocalyptic capitalism?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think, though, that there, that part of the apocalyptic experiences that we're all having collectively right now, that there's this sense of, like, that whatever stories we are telling, whether that be the story of Christ and as Christianity as we've interpreted it and experienced it up to the present, that there's, like, endings in that, that it's not about composting it, or maybe it is composting and maybe I'm looking at it all, you know, all wrong, but that the story itself doesn't serve us any longer. You know, it's like maybe talking about Christ is not appropriate, but or Christianity, but like just so many of the stories that we've been telling ourselves up to the present about how things should be and how things are just so impoverished and so off from what we're actually living in and experiencing.
The thing, like, that I think about a lot in terms of patriarchy and patriarchy's conflation with masculinity and, like, the Christ story as authored solely by the church and by men, pretty much, is that we're experiencing narrative dysbiosis. That a couple of you know, it's like what happens when you give someone too many antibiotics and it kills off all the microbiome in their gut. And then they have a bloom of candida or some pathogen. And the thing is not to go in there and try and kill the pathogen, but to take probiotics and eat fermented food and to eat some dirt and to crowd out and repopulate the gut with healthy microbes again. So I've been thinking about something like, so you said, like, is the Christ story done? I don't think the 2 years of teaching of a relatively young rabbi who then is assassinated by empire in Galilee is going to necessarily be like the really most helpful story for us right now. No, I don't. Mm-hmm. But I think that if we look at that story, it can tell us that a biodiversity of stories that honor nature parables might be helpful. So I think the answer is as many stories as possible, not to end any stories, but to add more stories in, add a probiotic of stories in, ferment the stories. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't want to give your, like, the entire book away or anything like that, but like, how do you, attempt to, or how do you do that with this story that you've written?
I think the thing that I've always, so I've been a lover of historical fiction and fiction. I'm a big reader. And I really don't like a lot of modern fiction because I don't think people do a really good job with characterization. There just aren't enough characters and relationships. And I always think that, you know, we're constituted by a relationship. So if you don't have, like, if you don't know the trees that are growing inside your story, the people, their grandparents, their feelings, then your story isn't alive. It doesn't have a circulatory system. And so, and the pieces of fiction that I've really gravitated for have been fully fleshed. They're not just the story. Maybe there's one storyteller, but there are like 50 fully realized characters and the ecosystem is fully realized. You can taste it. You can smell it. I think one of my favorite examples of this is the storyteller, the queer storyteller, Mary Renault, who wrote The King Must Die, The Last of the Wine, The Persian Boy, that these are historical fiction projects where every character lives and breathes and has motives. So I think that I wanted to do is I wanted to bring back to life, I wanted to quote unquote resurrect Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and the people, all of the people in those stories, the disabled people, the females, the queer people, and the Jewishness, the inherent Jewishness of that time period. So if anything, and what I'm trying to say is that just like we as human beings aren't really an individual, we have more bacterial cells in our body than we do human cells, that we have fungi growing on our skin, that our very cells are the product of symbiogenesis, which is different organelles coming together through this kind of collaborative anarchic act of fusion, that we are nested matryoshka dolls of being. And I wanted to show that the Jesus story, which looks like a monomyth, it looks like monotheism incarnate, is actually a living, breathing ecosystem of many, many different competing stories.
I think it was in another interview you did. I think you were discussing, I think Christ came up as a, and it was intertwined with the work you're doing around masculinity as well.
Yeah.
And you do draw on other figures.
To discuss this as Yeshua well, is but... not my like, not my dominant. I actually always think of him as being like a bad story, like a not a very helpful story for masculinity. That he is a vegetal god. That story is aborted. That story is interrupted. That a true vegetal god gets to go back into the ground and get mulched and then sprouts back up, freshly adapted. Osiris is scattered back into the ground that he fertilizes. Dionysus is planted back into the ground. And in Yeshua, Jesus's story, he evaporates. His body leaves the virtuous cycle of decay and regrowth.
Yeah, I guess that kind of speaks to just the... that quality of how Christianity maybe has evolved over the centuries is this sense of disconnection from the earth itself.
Well, yeah. I think the thing that I think about a lot is I have a lot of compassion for the impulse behind that initial schism between body and mind, spirit and matter that then gets co-opted by Cartesian dualism. You know, you can change the terminology, but it's still theology. You know, current scientific reductionism is Christian theology. People don't really get that. But for me, when you see this this break between the body and the mind that Christianity really reifies, it's a traumatized people. You know, it comes with the fall of the Bronze Age. We don't really know what happened during that time, but we know that there were incredibly intense climatological pressures, there were genocide, there were agricultural failures, there was incredible social strife, and that the people, and then you have Judaism itself as being the spirituality of a people who are constantly oppressed and killed and relocated. So of course these people are frightened by embodiment. Embodiment meant death and pain and starving and being imprisoned. So you can see that begin to be articulated in the spirituality itself, especially post-Second Temple period.
Mm-hmm. Well, so then how do you, in uncovering all of that, placing it within its ecological relationship or its place, I mean, you talked about it like as if... you said, I believe, that you felt like you were going to die, or that you had this, I have to get this out and I have to write this now because there's a time constraint here.
Yeah.
Why did you feel compelled to tackle this subject and to write it and to bring it up right now in light of everything we've just sort of discussed up to this point?
I think that what you love loves you. And we're all here for different reasons. And I think that for me, there have been the stories that I can't stop thinking about. The stories that I've known that I will want to write. And there are about five of them. And they're just in a line where they all include incredible amounts of research and time. And it's not that they're the most important stories, but they're the stories that drive me crazy. They drive me nuts. So I can't tell you that I think that this story is the most important story. It is the story that has bothered me the most. And it was the story that bothered me the most until my next project, it's funny. The next project is the one that I probably care the most about. But the Jesus one really came up and really poked me. You know, I have family in Israel, and I was raised inside, I wasn't technically Jewish, but my aunt and my family through her are all Israeli Jews. So basically all the holidays I celebrated as a child were Jewish holidays. The joke in my family is when I was five, I said to my mom, I was like, am I Jewish? She was like, no. But I spent a good deal of time in Israel when I was a teenager, and I got sick. Like, I had this genetic illness, but it didn't kick in until I was 16 in Jerusalem, which is so funny. Wow. So it was almost like I didn't choose this story, but it like came into me, which is that's a story in and of itself. I'm not saying that's true, but there was this sense that the story chose me and that I couldn't ignore it. And there reached a moment in my life where it was yelling at me that it had to be written.
Is that how it feels when you're writing anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think the flavor of the projects that I care most about is that they come in pretty much somatically. I usually get really sick. They usually come out, and I'm actually trying to decouple those two things. I'm trying to problematize that a little bit and say, like, okay, what if the creative process didn't feel like this agonizing physical birth process? What if it could feel a little bit more playful and tender? Stories usually come in and I can't stop thinking about them, and then it becomes like an emergency. I have to write them. I've written two books in the past 6 months, and that's definitely felt,
oh my God,
that's been a different flavor. They've both been nonfiction, and they've both happened so fast that it felt kind of like a nightmare.
Oh, man.
Yeah. But we'll see. Maybe I'm done. Maybe I'm not.
Well, yeah, I just, I don't know what to say to that.
It's just unfortunately honest. It's just like not a super planned experience. I mean, it's planned when it happens. I'm very diligent and very... deliberate about how I pull these off.
Right. Well, I guess I just mean there's like this stereotype or this sort of thing of a stereotype, whatever the word is, this sort of thing of the agonizing or the troubled and
I know,
miserable, suffering artist, and there's always that truth within it, right?
Well, I think it's what I kind of said about embodiment, which is like to feel deeply is to feel both the deep pain and the ecstatic pleasure. And I mean, I don't love anything more than inviting a story in and feeling it take me over. I mean, it's so much fun. I love it. That's the reason. Yeah. I don't think I could write a story that I wasn't in love with that didn't totally dominate my thinking.
Sure.
And in fact, that's actually always a really good sign, is like, there've been projects that I've thought about and I'm like, that's a really good idea, but they don't stick. They don't make me feel happy and obsessed. Mm-hmm. Like, I fall in love with stories. It really does feel like falling in love. And yeah, there is that agonizing kind of compulsion that is paired with it. But there's also a deeply beautiful, obsessive, fun quality to it too.
Sure. Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. And yeah, this is probably the last point I would like to get to in this. How are you feeling right now, by the way? I know we started, you said you were feeling a little fuzzy, and I just, are you doing okay? You're doing okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. The other book project that I wanted to mention was The Flowering Wand. The subtitle of this, Lunar Kings, Lycanized Lovers, Transspecies Magicians, and Rhizomatic? Rhizomatic Harpist Heal the Masculine, yeah. And from my understanding, this deals with masculinity.
Yeah. This project is the funniest thing ever. This project definitely really felt like a possession experience in the best way possible. I went to the crossroads and was like, okay, I think I'm ready to like invite Dionysus inside. And it was like, get ready. We're going to be ready 24 hours a day. But I had held these storytelling gatherings in my house pre-quarantine for a while for women and femme and trans people, where people would come together and talk about health issues, talk about trauma. And it was a way of massaging personal narratives in a pretty intimate setting with food and laughter and wine, where people would help other people see their stories differently, tell new stories about old events. And they were really, really healing experiences. But it became super clear to me that not having men participate was a problem, and that men were masculine figures, you know, men as being kind of this idea, not any kind of biological or social reality. But that we needed to invite the masculine in order to really, really heal these stories. And just when that realization happened, quarantine began. So that didn't actually get to happen in a super real way, in person. Mm-hmm. But I had finished my book on Yeshua. I'd done a lot of thinking about the masculinity behind this celibate, ascetic, problematic figure. Was there a healthier figure behind him? And then I started to think about all of these masculine myths that I love and that seem to me to represent more anarchic, vegetal, ecologically relevant modes of masculinity. And that people get so triggered by masculinity as a term because it's been deeply coupled, problematically conflated with patriarchy. But masculinity is a biodiversity. It's a whole forest. It's a polyphony of discordant, sometimes harmonious songs.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had this complex relationship with it. And, I think I've tried to figure out a way to like not decouple. What is the right word for this? I've had experiences where I grew up thinking that men, if we're going to talk about this idea of men, having these just absolutely like I associated it with trauma or traumatizing those that I cared about.
Yeah.
And I knew that I felt a man. So there was this sort of dissociative kind of quality to it. So through the podcast, at least, I've been able to talk with others and think about this more openly and speak to it more.
Yeah. Your interview with Ian McKenzie was really great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. And you know, that was like, it's kind of like the beginning of this discussion with you is like, it was an unplanned thing that happened. It put me in this particular emotional state where all this stuff was coming up. And then I'm like, all right, I guess I'm going to talk to Ian today. And the timing was just sort of right for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, yeah, speaking about that relationship that I've had with it is like learning to own something or to recognize the multiplicities, the various aspects of this thing, this ecosystem of masculinity, as yeah. I think that's a beautiful way to describe it. And to, to kind of embody it the best way that I personally can, because I think that's a part of whatever we would define as healing.
Yeah.
You know, it is that.
Just and trying to tell new stories and trying on a new costume every day. That's the one thing I want to offer everybody, is that lunar knowledge, you know, so the solarization of our culture and our religions and our discourse has been that things are always bright and insistent and the same. You know, the photons move directly from the sun into your eye. But the truth is that life is much more lunar. It's much more cyclical, that some days we're waxing, some days we're waning. We're always both. We're always in process. Mm-hmm. So I also want to offer that I don't think anyone has to be masculine in one way for more than a second.
Mm.
I think that it can shift all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what to say to that, except I agree.
Well, are there any stories or figures that you felt offered a counterweight to the culture growing up or recently?
I don't know.
I mean, it's a hard question.
I don't know. It is, yeah. I think that's I don't know if I have an answer to that, but I'll just say as a part of that, I didn't really have that.
Yeah.
And I think that was what was such a struggle for so long, is that there wasn't, I felt. I would very rarely see glimpses of what was possible or what could be in moments, not in any person, I felt, because I felt like within every man that I had this problem, and I still have this thing where I idealize people and I put them on pedestals and then they disappoint me because they're people. They have their flaws. And I think men are carrying however many generations worth of bad behavior. And so I would see often glimmers of something that I was like, okay, that could be a real thing someday.
Uh-huh.
You know, but it isn't here yet. Or if it is, it's out of sight and I've been looking for it. That's how I've felt, you know, and maybe I could see it in certain archetypes, but I don't know if I ever met, I don't know if you meant this in an archetypal sense or in a literal.
No, both. Totally.
Both. Yeah, I don't know. Nothing really comes to mind, because, like, you know, like you talk about Christ, I've thought about him as a figure. And yeah, he's not really the best story of masculinity.
Well, he's also the Roman co-opting of the man they murdered hasn't left us with a person with a body and with real behavior and real desires and shame and questions and doubt. So it's hard for that person to be a role model, because they're an abstract noun, the Christ.
Yeah.
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 I mean, I felt it in myself. I think I wrote this book because I love men. Like, I am a queer person, but I tend to partner with men or people who identify as men. And some of my favorite people in my life are people who identify as men. And yet... Mm-hmm. The worst things that have happened to me have happened inside of masculinity and at the hands of people who identify as men. And so I knew I personally had to heal this. And I had to heal this not through one story, but through a lot of different stories. And I was thinking about having kids. I was like, well, what would it be like if I had a kid who identified as a man? I would want to have a lot of really healthy stories to offer them. So honestly, I think this book was an offering to my grandfathers, who I felt like were men who tried really hard and really screwed up, but had a lot of those glimmers in them. And I wish that they'd had better stories, and also to think about stories I'd want to offer to future children.
Yeah, I think that really say sums up, but in that thing about reading your work has been like you're offering stories here, and there's something very encouraging. It's like it's talking about the intensity of the experiences we're having right now. It's like while all of this stuff is happening that is really discouraging and does lend itself to I don't feel positive about a lot of things sometimes.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be like overly whatever the word is, sentimental or whatever, but like, you know, meeting people like you, knowing that people like you are doing this thing, it is also this other end of that spectrum of like there's some incredibly beautiful things being produced right now by really intensely beautiful people.
Well, I feel like, so, like about your podcast and about a lot of people, you know, one thing I want to offer, and this is you are the first person who's hearing this ever.
Oh, great.
Which is the next book I'm writing is set in the Dark Ages, and it's very much about the Tristan and Isolde myth and Proto-Arthurian legends. And something that's fascinated me is, you know, scientists consider the worst year on Earth to be 536 AD. Like, there was a volcanic eruption, all the crops died, it was like winter for a whole year, there was the plague, it was just the worst year ever. And this is also a time period when we have like no records in England at all. It's called the Dark Ages, not because it was a culturally dark time, but because we just don't know anything. There's no light on. We don't have that many burial sites. We don't have Roman coins. We don't have texts other than the hysterical raving madmen stuff of this monk called Gildas. That's it. But that's when the round table stories are born. That's where they're retroactively placed by later romantic troubadours, is in that dark period. It's like, and I always think of the round table as being a biodiversity of stories. It's not the story of Arthur. He hardly ever features. It's the story of a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. It's like a whole forest of stories. So something I was thinking about this time period is it's the Dark Ages right now, but we can create that round table of different perspectives. We can give birth to stories inside this kind of behind the curtain moment. That's my super messy thinking. Oh, I lost you.
Hello?
I lost
you. Hi.
Sorry.
Hi. No, you're good.
And my computer glitched.
No, it's good. You came back. I was like, are we done? No, but that was like a perfect time for that glitch to happen, actually. So, wow. It's a very dramatic exit.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, I just want to say that is, I think... Yeah, that's a good ending, I think, for this.
There we go. I mean, I really do want to say your podcast is, you were talking about, what is it, consolation earlier? So on a side note, I do feel like listening to you talk to other people is consoling.
Oh,
in a way that doesn't feel precious, it feels like honest. And I think that's the thing is when people aren't honest about how bad things are, it makes you feel more anxious.
Right. Yeah, that is a quality that some people in different ways have told me is like, you know, you're not sugarcoating it.
No.
You're just kind of it's like something I've had to learn how to do as well personally, which is in my own relationships where something difficult is happening.
Yeah.
And the person doesn't want you to just like, oh, everything will be okay. Like, let's think of the, you know, it's just like, this is happening. Let's just be in it together. Yeah. And then talk about it or whatever is net, you know, maybe be silent, just whatever it is.
Yeah.
Just exist in it and know that you have a partner in that or a companion in that. And that's enough.
Yeah. You just stay with what is for the current day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I actually was feeling kind of also emotionally just kind of like blah. And I feel creatively prickled. Thank you.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad that I could that we could have that. Yeah, because I was in a little bit of a funk this morning, and I feel like I've been pulled out of it a little bit. And so I'm really glad we had this conversation, Sophie.
Yeah, and I'm on your team, and if I don't know if I can ever do anything for you, let me know.
Yeah, I'll be sure to let you know. I mean, currently just in this transitionary period, just, it sucks to say this, and this is by no means, this is not what I'm asking of you, but the thing that I've been like putting out there is like, I need to make money and I need to figure out how to live in a new place, like material shit. And that's not what I'm asking of you by any means, but that's kind of like the space I'm in currently. Is like,
those are the real asks, seriously.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so like, I've been thinking creatively about how do I continue to do the podcast in the focus way that I have been for the past year and a half, well, few years actually, and do that while paying rent in a new place. And just, it's a whole thing. So, you know, that's where I'm at currently with myself.
We're all hustling these days. I mean, I think people who are part of our generation are just, there's no career. We're just, you know, throwing shit in the air and trying to make it work.
Yeah. I mean, and I just want to, you know, commend you because you're right. When I read the comments under your essays, you know, you publish them on Instagram and Facebook and I'm just like, yeah, you're really connecting with people. People are really resonating with your writing. And so it's encouraging to see that because I see what you're doing is not the same as what I'm doing per se, but there's this like sense of like the moment we're in and the time we're in and what we are trying to do is maybe give parts of ourselves over to others and be like, look, this is what I am able to create right now. And the fact that it's resonating with so many people is encouraging for me.
I mean, it's been pretty life-saving. Like, to be perfectly honest, it's been a bleak 2 years. This began as kind of like, I hope there are people who will resonate with this. So the fact that it has been very cool. I'm honored to be part of this conversation.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for the time, Sophie. I appreciate it very much.
And good luck with your move.
Thank you. Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about my work, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support my work, there are a few ways to do that. The first thing you can do, of course, is subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is on numerous platforms, so wherever you listen to podcasts, it should be there. So consider subscribing. And if you'd like to support this work monetarily, there are a few ways to do that. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal and Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. Or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. And if you would like to support my work on a regular basis, on a monthly or yearly basis, you can do that through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And if you support my work there, you will gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly. You will find other exclusive content there as well. So to everyone that is a supporter of my podcast, however you choose to do that, thank you very, very much. If you would like to leave an audio message that can be featured on the podcast, you can do that through two means. You can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a message up to 3 minutes long. Please let me know what your intention is with the message so that I can then choose to feature it or not feature it on the podcast. If you would like to also just go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com, you'll find a link at the top of the page that'll let you drop an audio file if that is preferable. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much again for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a great week.